Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of October 4th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jay?
Oh, great. We're having a kind of a blustery, rainy day down here with high wind. You might actually hear the wind in the background from my office. It's really howling out there. Let's take a look at space weather, speaking of weather, from spaceweather.com. Mike, what's up with the sun over the next couple days?
Well, there was an M-class solar flare that has sent a CME toward Earth. NASA models predict that it is going to strike Earth around October 8th. Although it's a minor CME, it could spark a good geomagnetic storm thanks to the Russell McFerrin effect. So keep your eye out for that coming up next Wednesday is the estimate. And in the next 24 to 48 hours here in mid-latitudes, we have about a 40% chance of active conditions and seeing some sort of solar activity. Very low chance of a severe storm, only 1%. But if you get up to high latitudes, the chances of a severe storm do jump up to 55%. So if you're up around the Arctic Circle or somewhere far enough north, you might keep an eye out for northern lights. So what's happening in the night sky this week, Jay?
Well, it's kind of all about the moon this week. The full moon arrives late Monday at about 11:48 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And usually the first full moon in October is traditionally known as the Hunter's Moon. This year, however, it earns two extra titles. It's both a supermoon and the 2025 Harvest Moon. It's a supermoon because it occurs near the perigee, or the moon's closest point to Earth, and it makes it appear slightly larger and brighter than average, and though the effect might be pretty subtle, but I notice it in my telescope a lot of times that with the field of view when we have a supermoon is actually almost doesn't fit into the field of view sometimes of my telescope. It's taking the Harvest Moon title this year because it's the full moon occurring closest to the autumnal equinox. So the Harvest Moon is always called, is always named that because it appears closest to the equinox. And usually that actually happens in September, but this year it's in October. Adding to the spectacle, the moon will cross in front of several stars of the Pleiades cluster on Thursday and Thursday night or Friday morning, and this will create a series of occultations where you can visible to many observers across North America. So you can see the stars, for example, Electra in the Pleiades. Will be occulted by the moon. Depending on your location, look right around midnight Thursday night or just after midnight on Friday morning. Now let's take a look at some space news. Mike?
Yeah, Jay. And before I jump into our news, I want to just mention that last night during my time lapse, I captured a moon bow. So that was a rainbow that was created with moonlight. And so we're, waxing gibbous moon phase, still a couple days away from full moon, but it was bright enough and there was some rain going on. In fact, it was, a little nerve-wracking running a time lapse with cameras outdoors, but I was rewarded with a moon bow that lasted for a few minutes and it was a fairly bright one. This is only the second time I've ever managed to capture this phenomenon. So it's somewhat rare. You do need a pretty near full moon to have enough light to actually create the rainbow. And then, of course, you need the conditions of clearing sky in one direction with some Rain or Virga in between you and the moon. So kind of excited about that.
Wow. So I was just going to say, now I have to go check my cameras and see if I caught that. We're getting that rainstorm right now. So,
right.
Okay, so on to space news.
Yes. A newly discovered asteroid designated 2025 TF made an extremely close approach to Earth at 1249 Universal Time on October 1st, reaching a nominal distance of 0.02 LD. That's the lunar distance, or the distance between the center of the Earth and the center of the moon. This places it approximately 6,800 kilometers or 4,200 miles from Earth's center, exactly 4,220 miles to be precise, and that'll matter in a moment. That's equivalent to about 419 kilometers or 260 miles above the surface over Antarctica. At this distance, it is now classified as the second closest asteroid flyby ever recorded. The newly discovered 2025 TF is ranked as this. Oh, I have some duplication here. Sorry. Since January 1st, 2025, observatories worldwide have detected 118 asteroids passing within one lunar distance of Earth, including this one. In September this year alone, there were 25 asteroids that passed within one lunar distance of Earth. And I would say that the asteroid that holds the record is 2020 VT4, and that passed 4,190 miles from the Earth's center on November 13th, 2020. So that was about 30 miles closer than the one that we had here on October 1st. 2025 TF was discovered or first observed at the Kitt Peak Bach Observatory in Arizona at 6:36 a.m. Universal Time on October 1st, less than 6 hours after its closest approach. So we detected that after it had already passed by. And this object belongs to the Apollo group of asteroids and has an estimated diameter of between 1.2 and 2.7 meters. That's about 4 to 9 feet. It flew past Earth at a relative speed of 20.9 kilometers per second, or 46,700 miles per hour. A lot of these near-Earth objects are being discovered by amateur observers, and that brings us to our topic today. We want to talk about confirming reality through direct observation. In other words, knowing something is real by imaging it or observing it yourself. So over to you, Jay.
Yeah, you know, we read about it and we see all these incredible images online, and you know, and you kind of get detached from reality. You know, when you say, when we see, for example, you know, the pillars of creation from the Hubble telescope, or you see a nebula, or you see these pictures of Andromeda. And if you're experiencing it through media, you don't really have a connection with that to reality. And so there's, you know, there's a unique and powerful satisfaction in confirming these realities through your own eyes. In other words, seeing these things for yourself. And that is why so many of us are kind of drawn toward amateur astronomy and astrophotography. We can look up at the night sky and you know there's light that you're seeing from a distant star left it 1,000 years ago. And that's a staggering intellectual concept. It becomes a visceral, undeniable truth when you're at the eyepiece of a telescope or looking through the viewfinder of a camera and you are actually witnessing those photons that left that star or galaxy many, many thousands of years ago, and you're experiencing it for yourself. There's a galaxy, say, the Andromeda Galaxy, M31. It's a faint, fuzzy smudge in your small telescope. You've seen the Hubble image, but the moment your eye registers that light, that ancient signal, you're not just reading a fact, you're confirming it. You're the second witness to its existence right after the telescope's mirror or your camera's lens. You're personally verified that there is a massive collection of billions of stars over 2 million light years away. So this is kind of your personal experience, and you are basically the first person in the universe to see those particular photons. And so that kind of brings us to astrophotography. And why do we go through all the trouble of buying the gear, setting up, tracking, worrying about the weather, battling the dew, and spending hours of processing our images? It's because the resulting image is your personal irrefutable evidence. I used to be, I still kind of, I don't really pursue deep space objects per se and do a lot of astronomy for deep space objects. And the reason being is that, that there's so many other images out there that have been created by so many other people that have so much, larger investment in both telescopes and astrophotography equipment. And of course, there's the space telescopes and all those things. And so they can image those things, tens, if not thousands times better than I can. But there's kind of a disconnect with reality there. And for a while, what I would do is to image these deep space objects is I would actually log on to a remote telescope and buy time on the remote telescope and say, okay, capture the images of Andromeda, for example, M31, for myself. And so that I would have that telescope capture those images. So, and then I would download that data and process it myself. And that gave it a kind of a personal connection to that image, whether, I could have just as easily, paid, $5 and bought a high resolution image of Andromeda imaged by somebody else. But that kind of made it personal and brought it to my own reality. So when you capture like a vibrant nebula, like the Orion Nebula, you're not just printing an image you found, you're creating a document of reality that you've actually personally witnessed. You've directed that camera toward a specific spot in the sky and pulled the signal out of the darkness that your unaided eye couldn't perceive. The color, the complex gas structure, that's real, and you've confirmed that existence and structure using your own instruments. It's the kind of the ultimate way of saying I saw it myself. And this is also, like navigating the night sky is kind of an abstraction. If you just look at it from afar or you look at a planisphere, is you don't really have a connection to where something is in the sky. So for example, where exactly do I look for, the Orion Nebula, or where do I look for the Eagle Nebula to see the pillars of creation? And once you image it yourself, you know kind of where that is in the night sky. And you can even, you can look up at the night sky and say, I know that the Eagle Nebula is right about there. So it grounds those abstract scientific concepts in the tangible personal experience. And it moves from, I believe what scientists say, to say, I know it's there because I have the data and I took the picture. And so, that's basically acting as confirmation. So, Mike, how do you feel about this? And have you kind of, I have the same kind of emotional experience that I have in confirming reality by observation?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. I'm always very excited to see something new for the first time that I've not seen before, to learn about it. So it goes both ways. There are phenomena that I've read about and heard about, and then I get to go out and see it for myself. And then there are other phenomena that are known about that I simply haven't encountered before, and I get to discover by photographing something new and researching exactly what that is. A couple stories that I've related on recent podcasts. The first one dates back to the late 90s. I was outside with my 8-inch Mead Newtonian, and all of a sudden all the dogs in the neighborhood started barking, and we saw what we thought was, or what appeared to be, a comet traveling across the sky. And the problem was, and I knew immediately, that comets don't appear to travel, not within moment to moment. Usually it's fixed up there, and this was had a tail, but it was moving, and all the dogs in the neighborhood saw it at the same time, and they all started barking, or at least a couple of them saw it and started barking, and that set everybody else off. And I had my telescope. It was moving fast enough that I could not really track it with the main tube, but I was able to use my finder scope to look at it, and that didn't help me much. The finder scope just didn't give me enough additional resolution to, with any certainty, say what I was looking at. So this is still, you know, we're talking probably about 1998. And so the internet was still an early phenomenon, but I turned to one of the news groups for astronomy and said, "Hey, I saw this thing last night around this time. This is what it looked like." And I got responses back from around the world. Some of them were a little fantastic. Somebody thought I was discovering or observing some micro comet thing that they had a personal theory about. But several people correctly identified this as being the time at which the space shuttle was executing a water dump. So another case that was like this, where I saw something and I didn't know what it was I mentioned on a recent episode, I saw what I thought might be a daytime supernova. And this was in our balloon episode. I pulled out my telephoto lens and started taking pictures, and I knew within a few moments of looking at the photo that, no, this is not a supernova. It's a balloon, and it only appears to be stationary because it's moving fairly slowly. So to go with things that I have directly observed myself that I knew about, the most exciting is undoubtedly sprite lightning. And I don't think we've done a whole show on sprites yet, or I've forgotten it if we did. But I had set up a camera that was modified with the infrared cutoff filter removed. I was doing a night time lapse, as I do. This was back in 2012 or 2013. And I went out to change batteries. I checked the focus after I touched the camera because I may have bumped focus. And I saw a little red smudge in the frame, and I really wrote it off. I thought, oh, there's a lens flare from a light somewhere, and it's no big deal. The next morning, I watched my time lapse, and I knew immediately that it was, in fact, a whole series of sprite lightning strikes that were captured, and I corresponded with another amateur astronomer, Thomas Ashcraft in Santa Fe, who had photographed the exact same sprites that I had photographed. Now, he uses very different types of equipment. He had much better photos than I did, but he could tell me that, that was a storm that was over the Oklahoma Panhandle. And it was really exciting to not only, you know, for the first time capture sprites, but to even have a fellow observer that I could, you know, discuss it with. And
That's one of the things that I wanted to bring that up while it's kind of on the tip of my mind there, is that one of the things that when I first met you is that we were both kind of, I realized that you were a good observer. And so often you'll, you know, have people that will come up to you and say, "Oh, I saw something last night that was really strange. Can you tell me what it was?" And, you know, that's not being a good observer. And being a good observer is, you know, being able to say, "I saw this to the southeast at, you know, 10:22 p.m. and about, you know, 30 degrees elevation, and it was red." And so... That I just wanted to, you know, interject there that, you know, being a good observer and being, you know, documenting, you know, what you observe when you see something like that, and then being able to confirm that with other scientific data is also an important, you know, aspect of this observing reality for yourself.
Yes, and it's a great point there. And I just want to throw in, because I was mentioning the fellow Sprite observer, Thomas Ashcroft. We'll include in our links an interview with him on the New Mexico PBS show, Colores. He opens with the quote from, I believe, Francis Bacon, "If chance favors the prepared observer." And Thomas's question is, if chance does favor the prepared observer, how does the observer prepare? How can I generate clearer perception? And it's a great interview, and you can learn more about Sprites following through on that link. A couple other things I just want to mention on this topic. You know, the observations of the SAR arc, observations of the what they're now calling the SpaceX Aurora. That one in particular, you know, was for me an entirely new discovery now, and really has only been known about for the last 2 years most to science, mostly because there weren't as many SpaceX launches up until the pace really picked up a couple of years ago. And these are things that, you know, I capture and then have to go investigate to find out just what could this be. And I don't always get a satisfactory answer when I capture some new phenomenon, or it doesn't come as quickly as I would like. I'll give you another example of direct observation that I think was meaningful to me. A mutual friend of ours, Matt Litt, had texted me one night to say that he saw this strange white glow in the sky that appeared to be slowly moving. And I went outside, and sure enough, I could see this diffuse white cloud that was clearly glowing. It was not, there was no source of illumination, and it was moving and traveling and distorting a little bit as it traveled. And we eventually pieced together that this was propellant that was dispersed or ejected from a SpaceX Falcon launch. And it took a bit of research to nail down exactly what that was. And even at the point of having come up with a likely answer, you know, I couldn't be 100% sure, you know, that it could have been something else. And so I have, over the 2 years since then, on a number of occasions, followed the launch schedule out of the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California, because that's where the Falcon launches are most likely to be visible to me. And it is to the point that I am able to go outside at night with the live launch audio on my phone. I'll tune into the SpaceX channel and play the countdown. And I'll stand out there with my camera looking to the west, waiting. And I'll hear that we have ignition, we have a successful launch. And at some point in the, you know, 5 to 10 minutes after that happens, the rocket is at an altitude where I am starting to see the propellant trail. And it does depend on the particular direction that the rocket is heading. If they've launched west over the Pacific, it's traveling away from me and I'm highly unlikely to see it at all. But if it's heading east or sometimes south, I have a pretty good chance of seeing it. And so, you know, there is an example of a very direct observation of something where I can connect the audio broadcast from SpaceX to what I see in the sky. And I know that it takes it, you know, about 5 minutes to, you know, escape the Earth's atmosphere and be up at an altitude where at 600 miles away, the propellant plume is now going to be visible to me. And I've seen enough of these now to know what those plumes look like. They're not identical every time. They can be different shaped or different intensity, but they have a general characteristic that I now feel confident that first sighting that Matt alerted me to was, in fact, almost certainly a rocket launch propellant. So I think the last two points that have to do with direct observation are sort of, the first one I want to talk about has to do with persistent contrails released by aircraft and the fact that I'm doing time lapses day and night. And I have known and lived amongst many people who have some degree of belief in the chemtrail conspiracy. And I have come at this with a, you know, skeptical mind of, you know, how do I know that what I'm seeing are, you know, persistent contrails left as a consequence of burning jet fuel and not actual chemicals being sprayed deliberately. And, you know, the one is unavoidable because when hot jet exhaust meets cold air, we get condensation. And of course, most of the jet exhaust is in fact water. So we get not just, you know, not just condensation of existing water in the air, but also of the ejected water. And, you know, there are a number of different ways of looking at and investigating this. But, I've done, for example, the reception of aircraft ADS-B signals so that I could help, you know, for my own purposes, directly identify what plane is that? Is this a military flight? Is this a commercial flight? And then where did it originate? Where is it headed to? And so, you know, being able to identify the type of plane and the origin and destination tells me a little bit. But seeing how contrails persist or don't persist in relation to the other clouds that are there already or not there already. And what we see in particular is there are what they call orographic formations. Oro is based on the word for mountain, and you get an uplift that occurs where clouds, where air masses are passing over a mountain range, and the warmer, lower air gets pushed up to a higher elevation where it is cooler, and that often causes the creation of clouds that happen right over the mountain range, and they often persist. We get wave clouds that persist. And what we often see, and I'm sure you've seen this in your time lapses, is that you'll have a relatively clear day, but as planes pass over a range, there will be persistence right over the range itself. A contrail will form and persist. And it wasn't there before it got to the mountain, and it disappeared after it passed over the range. And this is pretty much the same thing that we see with, you know, naturally occurring standing wave clouds or lenticular clouds. It just happens that the ambient air is not moist enough to create a cloud on its own. And, you know, why would it be that every commercial jet passing over this range is leaving a short persistent contrail only when it goes over the mountain range? And then you watch the time lapse, and an hour later, suddenly there is a lenticular cloud that is forming out of thin air because there's now enough moist air passing over. I will also say that one of the things that I notice in my time lapses is from time to time, I see two or even three layers of clouds that are moving in completely different directions. We have low clouds that are moving to the east, but then there's a mid-level clouds that are moving to the, you know, the south. And then there's an upper layer of clouds that are moving to the north. And you start to understand a little bit more that, you know, the air above us is not a homogeneous column of air traveling in the same direction at the same temperature and the same humidity, but in fact that there are layers, and what happens at one level may be completely different when you ascend by another 1,000 feet. And so it's very, very difficult to predict when contrails will persist. And this is something that even the military has struggled with because, you know, your stealth fighters may still leave contrails, and that's not very stealthy. So the last point that I want to make is with a direct observation of the night sky, and again, related to the conspiracy theory world, this time with Flat Earth, that you start doing time-lapse videos day or night after night, week after week, month after month, and year after year. And I've been at this now for 13 years, since 2012, my first night time-lapse, as many nights as I could possibly do it. And so I've gotten to see the, you know, consequences of the Earth going through the motions of the year with regard to the tilt to the sun and the solar, the galactic plane or the solar system plane. And so I get to observe, you know, the recurrent zodiacal light that we talked about, I think last week or the week before, that happens both at the spring and fall equinox or around there. And this has given me an intuitive feel for how the Earth moves, both rotating and orbiting, and of course, observing and time-lapsing lunar eclipses, a sense for, you know, the shape of the Earth. I get that from compiling star trails and looking at the pole and circumpolar star trails and understanding that, yes, the Earth is in fact rotating. And that's what the motion that I see, or apparent motion that I see around the pole star. And I'll wrap it up here because we're just about out of time. But I want to make one last point about direct observation. And that is that, you know, we talk about the precession of Polaris and that our North Pole star is not going to be our pole star forever. Over tens of thousands of years, that changes. And it is not precisely the pole star. And one night I was setting up a time lapse. I had a kind of cool old TV antenna, and I wanted to pinpoint the TV antenna so that the top of the mast was pointed directly at Polaris so that I would have this star trail image with the antenna centered on Polaris. And I learned, because I made this time lapse, that Polaris is, you know, a little hair, a degree off from the actual celestial pole. And I had to reshoot it the next night to get the exact positioning that I really wanted. I was close the first night, but I'm like, oh, now I need to just go over by a degree in this direction. And then I nailed it the next night. So that's kind of my take on this. I think it's just very important for us to hone our skills of observation and to be willing to confirm the reality that is reported to us in media for ourselves.
Yeah, it reminds me of, well, the Sherlock Holmes quote is, once you get rid of the impossible, you're left with the truth. And so, and you know, just briefly, real quickly, we're going to be running out of time. And also, you know, for example, you know, the conspiracy theory that man never landed on the moon. And of course, we can confirm that through observation by using a laser aimed at a reflector that we have footage of the astronaut placing that reflector on the surface of the moon. And, so that's, so you can do scientific confirmation of reality, to debunk some of these conspiracy theories as well. I want to thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast, and be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. And you can also check out our personal websites wildernessvagabonds.com for Mike's, skylapser.com for mine. And of course, you can check out our show links for information that we've done through the podcast. And if you'd like to help us out, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skylapser. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky,
wishing you all clear skies.